It's a real honor to me to be selected to make this presentation, and it's a pleasure to be here. Karen Williams reminded me yesterday that this is the 20th anniversary of Calvin Sperling receiving the Meyer Medal, so that makes it a little bit more special for me. The title, already read that. Let's see, where's the advance? There we go. The lecture outline is from the title, a collection with some history thrown in about the genus Arrakis. The genus Arrakis originated, and let me see if I can get this. There it is. In somewhere in the southwest part of Brazil, northeast Paraguay, and it's going to do its own thing here. Okay. In sometime after a mid-tertiary uplift of the old Brazilian shield, and we still find the eroded remains of that uplift in the area that we presume to be the area of origin of the Arrakis genus. And we still find what we consider the most primitive, morphologically primitive, of the genus growing in that region now, Arrakis guarnitica. You see three leaflets. We have assumed another thing, that it originated from the Stylosanthes and the three leaflets. But there are three species in this section. I'll allude to that more. The peanut is one of three genera that I know of that produce fruit underground. And we feel that it was distributed over the South American continent by the forces of running water, by the most part, and because moving these fruit. And we still find that many of the taxonomic groups are confined to specific river valleys, except for those that were moved around by man. And when you see from the air, like Rio Paraguay and Brazil, western Brazil, how the main channel of the river, I'm not getting that cursor on the screen here. I'm sorry for those over here. But the main channel, but during the flooding times, how it makes the loops, and we find wild Arrakis growing in these areas quite often in the areas that and in Rio Grande in near Santa Cruz, Bolivia, we find the I'd like to get that cursor, but I can't find it. There it is. Okay. In the more ancient of those sand dunes, we find wild Arrakis growing there. Here in the Rio Mamoré, on the border of Bolivia and Brazil, we were in a boat that the island was bigger than the boat we were in, and we didn't have the opportunity to examine it, but there may have been wild Arrakis on that. Here, a wild peanut seedling growing, Arrakis durinensis, in Rio Seco, in this area of effluent. Now, there had been a lot of collection done in the old times by Jesuit priests and other people like that, and a lot of herbarium specimen, but limited amount of germplasm. Then in 1959, Dr. Walter Gregory, Dr. Jose Pietarelli, who is from North Carolina State, Dr. Jose Pietarelli from Argentina, and Dr. Antonio Krapovicus, a botanist from Argentina, these three men went on a six-month expedition collecting Arrakis. And they collected a lot of germplasm that didn't survive. You know, it survived. Dr. Krapovic has made herbarium specimens of all of these with a location, but their maps and roads were pretty far and few between. But they were concerned that they wanted to return to these areas. In 1960, they went back to some of the areas, but then it became obvious that a lot of these habitats were going to be destroyed, and this sort of thing started showing up in the 1960s, where they would push the forest down and start modern agriculture in between the windrows of the burning brush, and of course a lot of that was going to sugarcane to make alcohol, and then the chainsaw industry really became active in the deal. And it was cut and burn and cut and slash and burn, and they would plant brachiaria. And if they didn't use herbicide, the wild arrakis, some of them can survive in the brachiaria, but not all of them. But when they put it to a soybean field, here a soybean field that's prepared for planting, when they put it to soybeans and herbicides, the wild arrakis populations are gone. And so it became very apparent that we needed to preserve those. And then in the early 80s, especially Brazil, but other countries as well, started building roads. Brazil does not have a rail system, so they needed roads to get those soybeans and other crops to the coast for export, and build roads they did. And we were part of that, watching that and using those roads to collect the wild arrakis before they disappeared. And they didn't build roads to all of them, and I'll show you some of those roads. But this is one that was early on. But we found a wild arrakis marginata growing in the very edge of this cut field where they were growing upland rice. Then we returned to where Dr. Krapovicus in the mid-50s had collected Arrakis durinensis, the species I mentioned earlier. This is also it's been proven that this is the A genome donor to the cultivated peanut. We returned to that type location, and they built an oil refinery on it. Well, other places where habitat destroyed is especially on the airports, because when they clear the forest for an airport, that if there's a wild peanut population there, then it becomes at an advantage until they pave it with concrete or asphalt. So it was apparent that we needed to save, preserve those wild species populations. And then in 1974, the IBPGR was formed, International Board for Plant Genetic Resources, and that later became IPGRI and now Bioversity. I'll not spend any time on that, but Dr. Gregory and Dr. Krapovicus put together a proposal to IBPGR in 1975, a three-year proposal to collect arrakis germplasm in Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, Paraguay, and Peru. And Dr. Gregory invited me to participate. The first expedition, I couldn't find my slide showing the original maps of proposed collection, so this is drawn from memory, and so it's as best as I could remember. I couldn't find the original, but it was quite an aggressive three-year proposal. And Dr. Gregory told me, he said, "Charlie, we'll be through with this work in 3 years." Well, he was. He retired, and he turned his part of the leadership over to me, and we submitted, I think, a total of six more proposals, some for evaluation. The first expedition was in December 1976 to the Mato Grosso, Brazil, primarily to recover a species that had been collected many decades before, but had become confused, and it was quite an issue with some people. Arrakis diagoi was collected at Lagoa, the Lake Gaiba, on the border between Brazil and Bolivia. And they've returned, they had set aside the whole month of December to, and I was not able to go on that, and kind of thankful that I didn't, because it was a rough trip, but it was at the height of the rainy season, but I would have seen some country that I would definitely like to see. But they found Arrakis deagoi right on the lake shore of Laguna Gaiba, and they also had time then to do some work in Brazil. They actually collected about 8 different species, and 4 of those were new species. Then the second expedition began in March 77 to Argentina and Bolivia, and the plan was to collect both wild and cultivated Arrakis. And 2 teams were formed in Bolivia, one to go to the mountains in the Andes and one to go to the lowlands, and I participated in the one to the lowlands. And early on in 77 and a couple of years later, we did what's called airstrip hopping. We'd go to these airstrips and buzz the strip to run the animals off land, and there'd be someone that come out from the house and meet us. But we stopped doing that in 82. One of our colleagues sat down on an airstrip that had been taken over by drug people, and he was murdered, so we stopped that. But we often found wild Arrakis growing on those airstrips or very close by. So we returned to the walking, and we did a lot of walking. If there was not a vehicle available for us to rent, we walked. And I dare say we walked 30 kilometers in many of those days. But we found wild Arrakis nearly every time we struck out from a village. In the western Mato Grosso in Brazil, 81, had a pretty good road there. And we found Arrakis culmani. This was a new species. The wild Arrakis grows in quite a range on the South American continent, from northeast Brazil, where it's very dry, and this is a Caatinga forest. It had rained a couple of weeks before we arrived there, and it was very green. But the normal situation in that area is dry, dry, dry. And these there are 6 species that grow in this area, and they must have drought tolerance. And so this is something for the future. Moving west in Brazil to the Pantanal, this is a big swamp, maybe twice the size of Louisiana. It's about 500 meters elevation, and it's almost 1,800 kilometers from the Atlantic coast. It takes a while for that to drain out from the rainy season. And as it drains out, the wild Arrakis grow and germinate and grow in the margin of the forest, not out in the center, but in the margins. And we often find wild Arrakis if we can get there some way, mostly by walking. And it grows to up to about 2,000 meters in the Andes. And this is just one of the roads that we traveled, where they cut out a sandstone cliff. And we collected Arrakis batizacoi at almost 2,000 meters. At the time we collected this in 1977, it turns out this was at the time the only other genome that was recognized based on the chromosome morphology. And at that time, it was chromosome morphology that was being studied. And this one was published as the possible bee genome donor to the cultivated peanut. In 1980, Dr. José Valls, the man in the center, was hired as the Arrakis curator in Saint-Argent in Umbrapa, and he and I made our first expedition. The man on the left is the driver, and we made our first expedition to the western Mato Grosso in 1981. And we collected, this is one of the new species we collected. We collected from 11, we collected material of 11 different species on that trip, and 5 of them were new species that had never been collected before. And in the central Brazil, we crossed many bridges, some of them better than this, some of them not quite as good as this. And of the hundreds that we've crossed, we made it across all but one. But we often got rewarded because we found populations like this. And they're easy to find when they're flowering like this, but it's difficult to find seed when they're in flower, so we have to return to it at another time to collect the seed. But this is in the central part, Arachis decora. This is a shot from Bolivia, Dr. David Williams on the right and Dr. Visra Vargas on the left. The park director that we're looking from a mountaintop at San Jose de Chiquitos and looking into the Bañados de Azozag. This is a large swamp during the wet season. During the dry season, it gets really dry. And we were hoping to get into there, and the park director gave us permission to go in to the national park and collect. And we were really excited about it. And about 2.5 hours into the swamp, we collected one of the largest wild arachis plants that exist. And Williams and Vargas and Valls and I named it after our mentor, Dr. Krapovicazi. We also encountered a group of Guarani, and we showed them a herbarium specimen of a wild arachis, and they knew the plant, and they took us directly to it. It was in the sand dunes of the old Rio Parapati that had traversed that area many, many centuries before, but there was a wild peanut that they knew it. And we do our fair share of camping, and I'm not a camper, but we do our fair share of it. In 2007, Karen Williams and I went to Paraguay to collect a species that appeared at the time that it might be useful as a bred species, and in this area right here. When we arrived at the spot we were going to, just before we arrived there was a sign, a national park, and the man that we were with said, no way, not going to collect from our national park. So we turned around, and fortunately we found the species outside the park, but we named it Arachis flugi. And this is another shot of it. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. One of the more interesting places we collected from was central Brazil, Rio Corrientes. And just to the left, that river goes underground and traverses under a hill about 300 meters on the other side of the hill. It comes out again. And on top of that area is a wild peanut that grows. Here it's at the feet of Dr. Valls, and Krapovicus and Gregory, named it Cryptopotamica in the grave. One of my assignments from the beginning was to collect the rhizobium, collect the nodules, and put them in these desiccator vials and bring them back. We always had all the permits and everything that we needed to bring that material in, and those vials were taken to Dr. Elkin at NC State University, and he isolated the material and put it on glass beads. And to my knowledge, those rhizobium accessions are still available at NC State. This is Aurelio Scannini, a Paraguayan botanist that participated in many of our expeditions, and we always made herbarium specimens of the wild species and sometimes even the cultivated if it was unusual, but we have a herbarium specimen. We collected the cultivated peanut in the Andes. Here we're crossing the Rio Urubamba at the headwater of the Amazon. We had heard that there was a farmer, a woman farmer on the other side of this river that grew cultivated peanut, and we wanted to collect that germplasm. And here she's explaining to us that this is Herber Zavrita. He's a Bolivian soybean breeder that was helping work with us because he knew Quechua. And this lady was explaining that she grew a long season peanut on the top of the mountain and a short season peanut in the river. Now, this was the second time that we encountered this growing in the river. We were not able to document at that time growing in the river, but Dr. David Williams, and here's a shot of him adjusting his GPS in 1994, but in 1992, as part of his PhD program, he spent 2 years, he and his wife spent 2 years at Rurrenabaque in North Bolivia, and he was able to document the growing the peanuts in the river. They would plant the peanuts as the water receded during the dry season. They would plant the wild peanuts, the cultivated peanuts and other crops in the sands of the river, and then when the water came back from the rains in the wet season, they would harvest their crop and save seed. Beginning about 2004, Dr. Viles and I started returning to the sites where we had collected and used aerial maps for location to document, first, if we could find it, and secondly, the exact location with GPS, because it's important to have that exact location for a lot of reasons I'll not go into here, but we were never more than just a few seconds off from our aerial maps. We had some very good aviator maps. We have often collected interspecific hybrids in the wild, and this is one of the interspecific hybrids that we collected in Brazil. We collected from the tribes in western Mato Grosso. This is the Mama Indi tribe that was growing a wild peanut for food, and they took us to their slash and burn field, and this is the wild peanut, Arachis vilisula carpa, and the cultivated peanut. They were also growing cultivated peanut for food. And the Arachis stenosperma is another species that is, the native location of that is in central Brazil, but it has been carried to many parts of Brazil and other countries by the hunters and gatherers of the past. And they've taken it all the way to the Atlantic coast, all the way almost to the Amazon, and they took it almost to Bolivia, using it for food, for a food crop. Now, we have collected more than 500 land-raised cultivated lines, 1,800 wild species accessions, and more than 75 new species since 76. And you see the areas that we have collected. Most of these, well, all of this is in the Andes, and that's cultivated. But the others is the wild species and some cultivated in those areas. But these are the areas that we have covered over the years. And in 1994, Gregory and Krapovicus published a monograph in Spanish, and Dr. David Williams and I translated it to English, and they described 69 species, including the cultivated peanut. And then Dr. Viles and I described 11 more species in 2005. And Viles recently described another species. And Dr. Guillermo Sejo has 10 more species that will be published possibly in December when... Excuse me, let me get... be published possibly in December, and data, we're gathering data, cross-compatibility and molecular data on 8 or 9 more, making a total of about 100 species in the genus Arachis, and I expect there will be at least 10 to 15 more species if we can get them collected before the habitat is destroyed, and these will be in Bolivia, in Brazil, and possibly in Argentina, maybe even Paraguay. But we'll collect some more. Now, there are 9 taxonomic sections in the genus, according using the taxonomy out of the monograph. The cultivated peanut is in the Arachis section, and it's 40 chromosomes, tetraploid that is diploidized, and there's another species with 40 chromosomes, Arachis monticula, the precursor of the cultivated peanut. In Rhizomatosae, there are 3 species that are 40 chromosomes, tetraploids. They do not cross readily with the cultivated peanut. There are 20 species in the Arachis section, the most advanced in the evolutionary chain, 30 species in that group with 20 chromosomes. They all cross readily with the cultivated peanut. Well, I say readily. That depends on the person that's crossing them, but for me, I consider them readily cross-compatible. But there's 1 species of 20 in the Rhizomatosae. The Erectoides, there are 14 species, all diploids. Procumbentes, 9 species, all diploids. The Coleorhiza, there are 2 species. In the Trisemonata, there is 1 species. And I'm going to give you some definitions of what they look like. 6 species in the Heteranthe. These are the ones that grow in northeast part of Brazil. They probably have drought tolerance. The Extranervosi, there are 10 species, and 3 species of the Triarectoides, the one that I showed you, what we consider to be the most primitive. Now, in the Arachis section, they all have this axonomorphic type taproot, even the cultivated. The cultivated, you can make a perennial out of it by removing the fruit and keep it from freezing. It will act as a perennial. It's basically an annual the way we cultivate it, but the cultivated peanut is basically has a taproot very similar to this, and all of them in that section do. The rhizomatous, of course, the rhizomes, and they all don't produce fruit. There's one. Florida has recently released a forage plant of rhizomatosi that they have developed to. That they say that they can reproduce it by seed, but I have spent many long hours digging and searching for seed of rhizomatosi. The Erectoides have tuberiform roots to survive the drought and the fire. All this area in the past would burn in the end of the dry season. The Procumbentes is very closely related to the Erectoides. Most of these species will cross with the Erectoides, but the root system is quite different. It has an axonomorphic type taproot, and the tuberiform roots go horizontally at 90 degrees off of that main taproot, and so they're quite distinct in the root system, and most of them have a shiny leaf type characteristic. The Coleorhiza, 2 species, and these are the examples of the leaf size from Arachis pintoi, and it's used quite a bit for forage. It grows in a very swampy, very wet area. And one of the unique things about this Arachis pintoi, it is the only other species other than Hypogea that has all 4 flower colors, the yellow, orange, cream, and white. And the yellow is the dominant. The Extranervosi section, as Arachis marginata, has these tuberiform roots like this, not like the Erectoides, but still tuberiform roots that have evolved to survive the drought. And one of the species has pegs on the that have roots on them, Arachis prostata. Now this is a picture of the Heteranthe, Arachis dardani, where they had cleared the area. And it came a rain, and all of that green that you see is Arachis dardani. And those plants may go into dormancy when they run out of moisture. If it doesn't rain again, they would go into dormancy and just kind of sit there and wait for another rainfall, and then they might produce seed. But they produce a lot of seed when they have the moisture to do it. It's a perennial of sorts. Another species of that section is Ceridoensis. And it grows in an area where there's just not a whole lot of soil. It's mostly gravel, mostly rocks. The Trisemonata, 3 seed per peg, and it's easy to see why it is very distinct, and it doesn't cross with anything else. And then the Triarectoides, there are 3 species in this section, and three leaflets only. Moving on to the preservation. Almost all of the cultivated species accessions produce enough seed so that they can be increased and stored for varying lengths of time. And of course, that depends on the storage conditions. I have stored at minus 18 C Arachis hypogea that have been there since 1973, and they still germinate above 90%. About 65% of the wild species produce sufficient seed to be able to store for varying lengths of time. The other 35% some produced no seed whatsoever. Some groups of wild arrakis produce as adequate seed, but not, they can't be stored. They do not survive in stores. And that is the Arrectoides section primarily. They will stay viable in storage about 2 to 4 years, with some exceptions. There are some exceptions to that. None of the rhizomatous successions produce enough seed for storage. Thus, a large live plant collection is absolutely necessary to maintain a complete collection of arrakis peanuts. In the rhizomatous, this is from a 12-inch pot. About every 4 years, we have to break them out of the pot, whether it's clay or plastic, and chop them up and replant a portion because they will burst a clay pot or a plastic pot if we don't. These two benches here are 4-inch pots of cuttings as a backup cutting of everything that we grow in the greenhouse, of things that don't produce seed. When we've returned of the material from South America, we would always plant, if it was a seed producer, we would plant it in these half bushel baskets and produce a crop. In the second crop, we would plant two plants per half bushel basket, and then we would go to the field plots. And we would try to isolate by planting adjacent sections that would not cross-pollinate. But you can imagine that is quite attractive to a bee. And we found that we were getting just too much cross-pollination to maintain a viable accession for preservation. So we've moved back into the greenhouse on all this, or a screen house, because of just too much cross-pollination in the field. In the cultivated, we're comfortable growing those in the field. Over 48 years, I've run three studies for studying cross-pollination within, and I've never had cross-pollination from one row to the other. I have up to 3% within the row, but never from row to row. So I'm comfortable growing the cultivated in the field. And here's just a shot of seed that are ready for cold storage. But the best way to preserve them is in situ. And that would be the ideal. If we can convince landowners that have a wild arrakis population to not destroy it. Of course, that's difficult to do. Some of them survive along the roads, and this will survive as long as they don't use herbicide. But on this last expedition in May, we found that they were using herbicides to kill that nasty old weed that was growing there with those yellow flowers. They were trying to get rid of that thing so their grass would grow. Now, moving on to distribution of the material that we collected, our charge from IBPGR was to collect arrakis germplasm and leave a sample in the home country, and then bring a sample to the USA, multiply it, and distribute it to the U.S. National Collection at Griffin, Georgia, and to ICRISET. And this was accomplished for about 85% of the collections, cultivated and wild. But some of the more difficult, both cultivated and wild, have not been established either in the U.S. collection or in ICRISET's collection. Some of the attempts to ship germplasm to ICRISET were unsuccessful. We had boxes, dozens of boxes that were fully documented, but they just didn't get there. So we're disappointed about that. Distribution to the U.S. collection were more successful. However, there are several more of the more difficult ones that still are growing in Stephenville, Texas, but not in Griffin, Georgia. Also, budget cuts and loss of personnel have contributed to losses of some of the wild arrakis at Griffin, unfortunately. Evaluation and utilization, I haven't really separated those two, because for me, it's hard to separate the two. We've studied many herbarium specimens. This one happens to be in a Paris museum, but we study herbarium specimens, we study live collections. And when I took this picture, Batizacoy was the largest leaflet plant, but after we collected Crapavicazia, it should be in this picture, but I haven't taken that picture. But Arrakis linearifolia, a very small leaf. And when you see the seed coat colors and the cultivated material all put together, it's quite an array. And Dr. Bill Branch in Georgia, he'd have a field day trying to figure that one out. The flower colors, I mentioned the four flower colors. Here I had them all growing in very close proximity in the field, all except the yellow. We spend a lot of time studying flowers because these red lines that you see, they occur on the front of the standard. They occur on the back. They occur both on the front and the back. Some of them don't have any red color to them. Some only a blush at the base, like you see at the base here. But we spend a lot of time studying those to discern different materials. And of course, we study the root systems. I showed you this one earlier. We study those root systems. We study the pegs, the structure that pushes the seed down into the soil. These don't grow vertically; they grow horizontally. It's a distribution mechanism to get that seed out away from that main axis, as long as a meter for distribution. We receive some funding from the IBPGR to do evaluation, and we assign 23 passport descriptors to all the cultivated and wild species that we had collected up to 1983, and then from 77 to 86 we did the passport and minimum descriptors of all the cultivated material. We assigned 53 descriptors, 21 passport, and 32 morphological descriptors. Unfortunately, at the time we did this, molecular biology had not arrived yet. It would have been nice to be able to have the molecular data to go along with these data now, but unfortunately it didn't happen. I made my first interspecific hybrid in 1968. I chose Arachis durinensis as the male, crossed it onto cultivated peanut, got me a triploid hybrid, and here I was fresh out of my PhD and I knew everything, but that triploid made seed, and I was a little bit puzzled about that, but we've figured that out since then. It was an auto hexaploid. I have spent many, many long days and hours making crosses to discern the cross compatibility, the identity of whether we could call this a new species or whether it was totally different. Those are the pollen stain percentages, and we use that as a relative term for fertility, not as fertility, but as relative, and we use that a lot. And as I mentioned, the Arachis pflugi, this is a species, and Arachis wallacei, the species that is going to, those two species are going to be very important to us in the integration program. Matter of fact, they are very important to our program already. The cross that formed the cultivated peanut, and this is proven by molecular analysis now, Arachis durinensis by Arachis epaensis. Epaensis is only collected in one location, and at the present time we consider it to be extinct because we can't find it at that site anymore. We can't find the site, as a matter of fact. The B genome donor and then the A genome donor, Arachis durinensis. The problem here is that we can't make the cross because the molecular biologists tell us that the durinensis had to be the female, and we can't make the cross that way. We can make it with the B genome as the female, but we can't make it the other way around. We'll get that figured out one of these days. Molecular biology is probably going to do that for us. I mentioned the Arachis diagoi, the object of the first expedition. It was found that the Arachis diagoi is resistant to early leaf spot, matter of fact, immune to early leaf spot. This is cultivated leaves, but the Cercospora arachidicola and the Arachis cardinaceae is immune to the late leaf spot, Cercosporidum personatum. And when I went to work in 1967, I inherited a program to develop leaf spot resistance, both early and late. And so I was quite interested in this information when it became available 1972. So I immediately made the cross between the two to try to combine those resistances. Produced a hybrid, cosacine-treated amphiploid, crossed it with hypogea, 40 chromosome, and obtained seed. So I back-crossed it with hypogea, and I said, man, I'm on my way now. We're gonna have that leaf spot resistance. I promised the farmers that I'd have it before I retired, but I thought, well, I'm going to have it a long time before that. But much to my surprise, in that first back cross, everything was sterile. Not a pretty sight. But about that time, the Arachis batizicoi, it was published that the chromosomes were different, and this must be the B genome donor, so I immediately crossed that with my hybrid to get a tri-species hybrid, treated with colchicine, got a fertile amphiploid that was 93% pollen stain, and crossed it with hypogea and back crossed it, and we continued that program to the seven back crosses. We released a Texag 6, the amphiploid, and the first back cross. And we, in the back cross 4, we took material to outdoors to box plots, and you see the susceptible check and the lines that we selected. You can see that some of them were resistant and some of them were not. And now we advanced that, and now we have the high oleic trait that I'll talk a little bit more about in that material, and we're ready to release some of those. From the same cross, we also introduced rust resistance, Puccinia arachidica. Rust is not an important disease in the U.S. to peanut, but it is in other parts of the world. The only time we have it in the U.S. is when a hurricane comes over the Yucatan Peninsula and brings it to Texas or to Georgia, Florida, Alabama. That's about the only time we have rust in the U.S. But other parts of the world, it is really important. Another item is the root knot nematode, Lodigina arenaria. Arachis cardinacea, we transferred the gene resistance to Lodigina arenaria out of Arachis cardinacea, and this came through the Texag 7. When we discovered the resistance in cardinacea, we started looking because we knew we had a lot of back crosses. Well, we went back, had to go all the way back to the first back cross, but we already had it transferred into cultivated material, types that would cross with cultivated material. We released our first cultivar, Coin, grown in a field that is highly infested with the Melodigina arenaria. This is the check, susceptible check. And then we released another cultivar, Nematam, basically immune to the Melodigina arenaria. Other things that have been important, up until just recently, the oil content of other than petroleum has been very of great interest. The cultivated varieties range from 43 to 51, depending on the cultivar and the location it's grown. The Arachis section, the 30 species, range from 32 to 55. The Erectoides section range from 38 to 64. And so this was very important to us, and we've transferred oil content into the cultivated peanut. We have cultivated lines that are above 60% now, and we're looking to release some of that material in the future. Those genes came from the area very near what we consider to be the point of origin of the genus. Not from the wild species, but from cultivated, we transferred resistance to tomato spotted wilt into Tamarind 96, the susceptible check on either side of the plots, and this saved the industry, peanut industry in South Texas. Our strain of tomato spotted wilt must be less virulent than the one in Georgia, Florida, and Alabama because our cultivars do not do well in the tomato spotted wilt fields of Georgia, Florida, and Alabama. Those genes came from Guajamarim Bolivia. We collected in 1977. From the same cross, we also obtained sclerotinia resistance. Sclerotinia is a very devastating soil-borne disease, and we have material that it's not immune, but it's highly resistant to that material, and that's available to the growers now. Arachis precox is a plant that grows in a swamp. After the end of the rainy season, when the water dries up, the seed germinate, the plant grows, flowers, fruits, matures the fruit, and dies when the moisture is all gone in a period of about 45 days. So there must be some early maturity there. The problem is it's lacking two chromosomes. At least when they're count, when you count them, it only has 18. I'm convinced that those other two chromosomes are there somewhere, and I'm waiting for a molecular biologist to show me where they are. I mentioned the high oleic trait. Olive oil is recognized as one of the best oils because it's high in oleic acid and low in linoleic acid. And the oleic safflower is the same way. Most of the peanuts, normal peanuts, are mid-range in that, higher than some crops, but not as high as others. But technology from the University of Florida, we obtained high oleic peanuts, and those are in the range of olive oil. This transmits to the cultivar, to the peanuts, when it's roasted, a very long shelf life. We don't really know how long the shelf life will be. My wife makes peanut brittle out of it, and I can keep it for a long time stashed away in my office. But without the candy, the sugar part will break down before the peanuts do. But it also is more heart healthy than the normal peanut. Other integration programs include the southern blight resistance, Strocium rossii, and drought tolerance. Drought tolerance is going to be something of the future that is going to be extremely important, and we're looking towards those species that come from the dry northeast part of Brazil as a possibility. Now, one other trait that I want to mention, my training and master's and PhD program was in forage grasses. And when you talk about forage grasses, you generally talk about Apomixis. And so I was fresh out of my PhD working with Apomixis, and I saw these twin seedlings in peanut. And that's one of the things you look for in forage grasses, twin seedlings. And I said, Apomixis. So back then we did sectioning. They don't do it that way anymore. I'd like to be able to do that myself. But anyway, so I made sections, and I pollinated with foreign pollen and things like that you do to study that, and the breakdown of the sexual tissue. And when the sexual tissue breaks down, then these new cellar cells become active and make embryo sacs, make embryos, and make twin seedlings. And I showed it to David mentioned Dr. Bashaw. Bashaw was my advisor. He was my major professor. And I showed the slides to him, and he scratched his head and said, "It is Apomixis, but I have no idea what form it is." But I tried to put together a paper and get it published, and nobody would publish it because Apomixis does not occur in leguminosae. So I finally got it published in a CIOT workshop publication, but that's the way it goes. But now, this is our first molecular tetraploid molecular map. Dr. Burr is here. He takes the lead on that. I can grow the plants and he can do the molecular aspects of it. But now that the genome is sequenced, the characterization of the Arachis material, and the use of the wild relatives of the peanut should accelerate considerably. And how am I doing on my time? I'm just about finished. If few things I want to conclude with. Maintaining germplasm collections is imperative. It has been in the past, but it's going to become more so in the future, because with the molecular aspects, and especially in arachis because we're so far behind, but in other crops as well, with the genomes being sequenced, these collections are going to be very important. And with the sequencing, they have been the lifeblood, but they will be the lifeblood of the breeding programs of the future. This is my opinion. And I strongly encourage administrators to make sure germplasm collections are made use of. And I must say, my immediate administrator is here. He does a very good job of supporting me, and I appreciate that. And with that, I will conclude. If there are any questions, I'll give it a shot to answer them. Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the exact question.
I'm just curious about, I'm not an expert in the peanuts, but I mean, it seems that when the pigs go into the soil, are you seeing any differences with species and their ability to penetrate down into harder soil?
Oh, okay. I understand your question now. Well, we often find, the extra nervosi, for example. We went into an area that they were clearing, and it was a sandstone mountain, basically, with cracks in the sandstone, and virtually no soil, leaves and dead tissue growing in the cracks, and plants growing in those cracks, and some of those plants were Arachis prostrata. And I thought, well, where are the pegs going to go? Well, they went into the cracks, maybe 2 centimeters, and produced seed. And it's a perennial plant, but I can't imagine how it survived through the dry season like that. But we found seed in those cracks. The Ceratoensis that I showed is mostly stones and very little soil is much the same way. The pegs do not grow very long. In general, in the cultivated, you think of that peg, the growth of that peg is a meristem right at the base of the ovule, and it's light sensitive. You can get a peg up on the main stem, and you can put a piece of black tape on it, and it'll stop growing and make a peanut. But in the wild species, I've never been able to get that reaction. So I think that is an evolved reaction of the cultivated peanut, because we see this quite often in rocky conditions where the pegs do not grow very long. They generally will grow much longer in a good sandy soil. Good question. Others? Okay. Yes.
You mentioned species that grow in swamps and then, produce near when the water recedes. So are the seed very hard seeded? How is it able to survive extended wet?
It has obviously evolved a mechanism to survive. I can take, I've made interspecific hybrids and obtained the seed, harvested the seed, and usually let them rest for a while. Sometimes I get too excited and I want to break their dormancy with ethylene or something like that. But I have, as a matter of fact, I have some seed in my germinator now that have been in there for 36 months, and they're still dormant, and they're okay. They will remain as long a dormant seed seems to be immune to everything, and as long as that dormancy holds out. Now, the one of the species of the triorectoides, the Arachis tuberosa, it produces some seed, not a great many, but some seed. But if you harvest them and dry them down to storage percent, 10% moisture, they go into a dormancy that you cannot break. They're basically dead. But I can take those seed and put them in sphagnum peat moss, and I have kept them on my desk, re-wetting them for a period of 24 months, pull them out, and treat them with a little bit of ethylene gas, and they'll germinate. So as long as they're moist, they stay alive. But once they go into that dried dormancy, they don't rot. You can put them in the germinator, and they don't rot, but they will not germinate. You can beat them over the head with a whole keg of ethylene, and they won't break dormancy. Yes?
I'm one of the Florida ones that were with Arachis colorata. What's the southern and westernmost location where you might find Arachis colorata? Are there any over into Chile? And then also northern Uruguay. Do you ever find Arachis colorata located in either of those countries?
We have collected Arachis colorata within about 200 kilometers of Buenos Aires. But I'm not sure it wasn't carried there, but it appeared to be growing in the wild, but it was in a condition that it could have been taken there.
But never in northern Chile?
No, I never have seen any that was collected in Chile. I never have collected in Chile itself, but the western part of Argentina, it does not go into the mountain. Matter of fact, it in the Chaco, about as far west as I've seen it in Argentina. It generally does not survive the cold weather very well. My colleague there at my location, Dr. Jim Muir, he wanted me to participate in that because I have had experience in releasing cultivars, and he wanted my help to do that. But he wanted to name it Simpsonia, and I told him can't do that because that's not kosher. And he said, well, give me a name then. So I said, okay, we'll call it Latitude 34 because it survives up to Latitude 34. Okay.
Okay, I would encourage you to carry on conversations with Dr. Simpson. He's just, hard to turn off when he's talking about peanuts. But please join me in thanking him once again for a great talk.
Thank you.